So yeah, Mark, so what was it like for you getting out of prison? When were you released? I forget.
So I was released on September 12, 2018, around 2.5 years ago.
And what was that experience like? I mean, where were you, first off? I guess I don't even know that. I'm trying to recall the interview that you did with the A-Yard guys, and I should have listened to it before we got on.
No worries. I was at Ironwood State Prison. I had spent the last 16 years of my incarceration there, so I'd been there for a relatively long time. In total, I spent 21 and a half years in prison. I was sentenced to 26 years to life. Went to board, had a two-day hearing, was found suitable, and around 5.5, 6 months later, I was released. So I was released from the yard where I had spent my last 16 years. I had not left that prison for that entire time. I was literally just there. And I don't know how big of a prison. I mean, I don't know how much space it covers, but I would guess maybe a one-mile radius or something like that. Or not a 1 mile radius, maybe a 1/2 mile radius or something like that. But it was an incredible experience. After spending 21 and a half years in prison, being released was one of the most amazing experiences, you know, I ever had. I didn't think that day would come when I first went to prison, because people who were sentenced to life pretty much spent the rest of their life in prison. It didn't matter if you were sentenced to 7 years to life or 1 million years to life, you would spend the rest of your life in prison. So the day did come, thankfully. My sister and my daughter were in the parking lot on the day I was released. So they were the first people I seen after spending all that time in prison. And it was just amazing to step into freedom after being incarcerated for such a long period of time. I mean, I was overwhelmed with, you know, all type of emotions. I tried to keep them in check to an extent, because I knew there was a lot of work that I needed to do now that I was released. But on that day, I was just enjoying, you know, being in the presence of my family and being outside of prison for the first time in 21 and a half years. So it was an amazing experience.
God, I can only imagine. That's just, do you remember what were some of the things you did that first day? Did you have some things like a list like David had? He had a things he wanted to accomplish. Were there things you wanted to see or do that first day of freedom?
Right. So I didn't really have a list. There were a few things I knew I wanted to do. Like, I wanted to eat some filet mignon, because my mother used to make filet mignon for Thanksgiving. She would make a turkey and a slab of filet mignon. So I wanted to do that. I was also a certified Braille transcriber at the time. I wanted to get the hardware that I would need to start earning an income, which was basically a laptop and the software packages I needed to produce Braille. So we did that on the very first day. Of course, had to get the essential items, the clothes, basically left all the clothes I had in prison. So I just wanted to take care of the essentials, and I really wanted to just sit down and have a nice dinner with my family. So that was the first day. Stayed in a hotel, had a nice dinner, had a nice lunch, got the laptop, got some clothes, and prepared to check into parole the very next day at 12 o'clock.
Right. So many, I mean, imagining like getting out of prison, and I think people can kind of empathetically, you know, or sympathetically feel, you know, what you must have felt after all those years and being on the outside. Were there difficulties? Were there things that you didn't anticipate, you know, either emotions or situations that surprised you?
Yeah. So definitely. When you're in prison, you're in a very controlled environment, and then you come out and then there's times when you're around a lot of people. So when we went to the mall to get some clothes, just being around a lot of people made me feel anxious. Everyone kind of moving around quick. And even when the intercom system in the store would come on, it was kind of reminding me of yard alarms, which is strange. And I don't know if it was just because the sound was coming from above me where a yard alarm would come from. I don't know if it was that, but so that kind of made me anxious. And then I remember hearing stories about individuals who would get out and they would go grocery shopping, for instance, and they would stand in an aisle and there was just too many choices and they couldn't make a choice, right? And I remember hearing that when I was in prison, and to me that didn't make sense. And then I get out and I'm standing in an aisle trying to figure out what type of bread to get, and I'm stuck just because there's so many different choices. And then you start to feel anxiety, like, what's wrong with me? Why can't I figure out something as simple as what loaf of bread to get? So there were those difficulties. And I would say for the first 6 months, really didn't like being in crowds, really didn't like being the center of attention. Because in prison, if you're the center of attention, usually that's a problem for you, right? So didn't like being the center of attention. And then feeling like I had to catch up after spending so much time in prison. You're released with $200 gate money. You're staying at a transition home and you have to figure out how to get on your feet, right? So feeling like you have to catch up, you have to save money, you have to purchase a vehicle, you have to get enough to live on your own. All those things were a source of anxiety. Thankfully, you know, I had a full-time job, and then I had a full-time and a part-time job. And at one point I had two full-time jobs. So I was able to get some income. And I think another thing I struggled with is I'm super passionate about criminal justice reform. You know, you think about everyone who is still in prison, all your friends who have become your family, and they're still in there, and you feel you have that moral responsibility to be that voice for them. And I still feel that way today. But you'll start to feel yourself get pulled in a lot of directions at one time. And that was challenging, and it took me a while to figure out, you know, that I have to have balance in my life, right? Sleeping 5 hours a night is not healthy, right? so getting that balance was difficult. And I think the thing that brought it to my attention, you know, I was a certified Braille transcriber, so I was doing that, which was taking a lot of my time, and I was working with the Anti-Recidivism Coalition, who I still work for, and I was doing Hope and Redemption Team classes in Donovan at the time. And I was driving back to Los Angeles, and I was just so exhausted from the work, from working two jobs, from being out there advocating, that I fell asleep while I was driving. Thankfully, I woke up. The little things that you drive over that make the car vibrate or whatever, woke up, didn't wreck, but the very next day, I quit my job as a certified Braille transcriber, and I focused on my role as a life coach with the Anti-Recidivism Coalition. And then I realized I have to have balance. You know, there has to be some form of self-care. You can't just come out into society and try and catch up with people who have been here their whole lives and never spent a day in prison, right? It all takes time to come together and to find your own identity. Like, what is your identity now that you're out here in the free world, as we call it, and what path do you want to blaze? So all those things became difficult, but I was able to navigate it.
Do you so talking like David had said a lot of things that first day. I'm talking on the beach. This is in the video where he was talking about he couldn't help all day long, kind of orienting himself toward you know, to where Pelican Bay was, just physically. You know, I'm south. It's like still there was like a home base for him, and it was in Pelican Bay, and he was out, and he's going, oh, you know, the bay's like, you know, north of here. I'm at the river, and the bay. He was like always just situating himself that way, and so. If you come, it sounds like you came out, and I'm gonna ask David this question. Actually, came out and sort of just like not overcompensated, but just maybe felt driven to throw yourself into all of these. Did it feel like all of this stuff had to happen for you, like right now?
It did. It felt like I was waiting for this opportunity for so long, and now the opportunity is here. It's time to execute, right? No, there is no time to waste. But with me, I think, and I remember David saying that, my experience was just a little different, because out here in, say, Crescent City in Del Norte County, it's very beautiful. Like, who would not want to stop and see the ocean and see the Smith River and see the Redwoods? These are all incredible landscapes. But I was released from the middle of a desert. Which is in Blythe, and there's nothing to see. And I'm like, let me put this prison in my rearview mirror, right. And I don't need to stop and get anything to eat until we're a few hours away from Ironwood, right? Mm-hmm. and then we didn't stop. So there was that little bit of a difference, and I kind of really wasn't orientating myself to Ironwood per se, but I still, you know, was orientating myself to the prison experience. It's kind of that survivor syndrome. Okay, I've gotten out, but what about these hundreds of people who are just as rehabilitated as me, who aren't out because of, you know, the way the system is designed, right? So I think that was the tough part for me. And that's why I was so enthusiastic about going to speak at different events and trying to be that voice for individuals who are currently or formerly incarcerated. So it was that feeling of moral obligation. And I still have it to this day, because I know how separated individuals who are currently incarcerated are from the wider society, right? So when we come out, we want to speak up for our brothers and sisters who are not out. And to make sure that we change the narrative about what being formerly and currently incarcerated means.
So were there resources that you took? You said you were working with the ARC even back then. Mm-hmm. Were there resources that you took advantage of when you got out?
Right. So with me, I've been incredibly blessed. Right. As I say, I worked with ARC, but for me, you know, I walked into ARC's offices the day after I was released. So I was released on September 12th, September 13th. I walked into the offices. I had known about ARC. I worked with ARC while I was on the inside with Scott Butnick. We produced the first ever TEDx in a California prison, which was TEDx Ironwood State Prison. I had seen the legislation they passed, and they a lot of times had staff come out to the prisons where I was at. And were actively engaged with currently incarcerated people. So I was aware of that part. I did not think that ARC would live up to my expectation once released. And they exceeded all my expectations, right? They really was everything that Scott Butnick was saying they were. But really, when I walked into that office the next day, I was really just walking in there to say thank you. To say thank you to everyone from Scott Butnick to the intern, who are part of this criminal justice movement, who made it possible for me to come home to my family as a result of passing Assembly Bill 1308. And I got good time credit for Proposition 57. So I got out faster than I thought was possible. And I walked into that space to say thank you. But then once you're out, you start to realize, you know, you need help. You can't do it alone. And I paroled to Los Angeles and didn't have a single family member in LA. I'm not from Los Angeles. I was raised in San Diego. The reason I decided to go to Los Angeles is because that was the epicenter of the criminal justice reform movement. And then I walked into their offices, and then I liked the support network that existed in that environment. So I kept going back. And the resources they provided me with were extensive, and they provide them to anyone who wants them, really. They showed me how to get my driver's license back. It was an ARC member's whose car I first drove. They showed me how to open the first bank account that I ever had in my life. They showed me how to build credit. They showed me how to ask for help when I need it, right? So I would ask for help when I was struggling with things. I had a life coach who I could go to. And they actually showed me how to create a good resume. They hired me as an intern. So that was a source of income, $13.25 an hour initially. And then they hired me as a Hope and Redemption team life coach. But the resources that I knew that I needed was the healthy support network, learning how to navigate a society that was drastically different than when I first got incarcerated. And also the appropriate way, you know, to conduct yourself in business environments and stuff like that. So I was incredibly lucky to have those things. I know everyone doesn't have them, but if you were to parole to Los Angeles, ARC is one safe space where you can go and you can get all those resources. Because I think one of the things that a lot of formerly incarcerated people struggle with, myself included, is asking for help when you need it. When you don't have it figured out, like, who can you go to and ask questions that may be embarrassing to some, but you need to know, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, I was blessed to have those resources. And a lot of times I think that is one of the distinguishing characteristics as to if an individual comes back to prison or not. If they can locate those resources and tap into those resources, a lot of times that will be the thing that stops them coming back from prison, knowing about those resources and tapping into them. So I was just blessed to know where they were, to tap into them, and have been blessed ever since.
Wow. I remember from the interview with the AR guys too, I remember you talking about going in the day after you got out and going into ARC and it kind of taking off from there. So the work that the Anti-Recidivism Coalition did while you were still inside, and the laws that they helped champion and lobby for and get passed, directly affected you, right? That's how you got out.
Correct. So Assembly Bill 1308 was really an extension of Senate Bill 260 and Senate Bill 261. All three of these bills were the same thing with different age groups. So there was known as the youth offender laws, and it's basically, it's not a get out of jail free pass. It's when you go to a board if you're sentenced to life, which is one demographic that's impacted by. Not everyone has to have life to be impacted by this bill, mm-hmm. but in my case, it was the life sentence. And the commissioners who were appointed by the governor had to take into account how old I was when I committed my offense. That was one aspect they had to take into account. The argument being that your mind is not fully developed until you're in your mid-20s. As young children and young men were very impulsive and other things that come along with not having a fully developed mind. So they take that into consideration, and then they take into consideration all the rehabilitative programming you've done, how long you've been disciplinary free, have you educated yourself, and do you still pose a risk to society or not, right? So they weigh all those factors. But I can say with absolute certainty, without the passage of those three bills, and the last one took effect a couple months literally before I went to board. So I went to board on March 2nd. I had a 2-day hearing, and that law took effect, I believe, on January 1st of that year.
Oh, wow.
So without that law, in the years of work that it took to create that law, because that wasn't done overnight, it literally took years, I would still be incarcerated today.
Oh, wow. Wow. I guess it's kind of weird, but it's the being in the right place at the right time, right? I mean, dang.
It is. The criminal. Go ahead. Sorry.
No. I was just. Go ahead. Go ahead. You go.
Now, I was going to say that, the criminal justice reform landscape is a result of the work that ARC and a lot of other grassroots nonprofit organizations have been doing over the last decade or so. It has really changed, and now individuals are being given the opportunity to get out of prison. Now, we still have a whole lot of work to do. There's still far too many people in prison, but it has changed, and that's what gave me that opportunity, because a decade prior, it was a lot different, and I was still being in prison. It's changed so much that even when I was released, I was supposed to be on parole at the very least for 7 years, if not for the rest of my life, right? Mm-hmm. I've been out 2.5 years, and I got off of parole last week, right?
Oh, so, well, now how's that work?
So it was a fight. It wasn't like I just said, let me off parole, and they let me off parole. I think there were several factors at play. One of them is COVID. And a lot of people were released during the COVID pandemic who no longer pose a risk to society. But now there's more people on parole and probation. And so part of that is how many people can these parole officers actually manage, right?
I got it.
That's part of it. And I think also they had a law passed recently where they capped parole at 3 years. It wasn't retroactive, which means it didn't affect the people who were already on parole. It would affect the people who are coming out now. There was a 3-year cap. And in that law, I think there was a recognition that we don't need to have someone on parole for 7 years mm-hmm. or the rest of their life. 3 years is sufficient. And, if you ask me, I would say we don't need parole at all. After someone served their time, they served their time.
Right.
Now they're back in the community. But for those who do advocate for a parole system, I believe that there should be, some cap on how long a person should be on parole and what services parole are actually providing. Now, not here to pass parole, because they were actually helpful to me. When I got out, they ensured that I had a transition home to stay in. And when you get out with $200 gate money and you've been in prison 2 decades and you don't have nowhere to stay, you need somewhere to rest your head at night. And that was one thing that parole does very well. They'll make sure that you, at the very least, have a transition home. And then they had certain conditions of parole. But now, thankfully, I'm off parole.
Wow.
So I'm happy. And that shows how much the system has changed.
Yeah. That's, and congratulations on that. That's fantastic. It was laws passed by or championed by the ARC that got David out, I mean, there was, I forget the number. I've got to listen to his interview again. But so it's just the the very real, I guess, the work of, like, there's only my limited time being inside and being in this context, getting sort of the skinny from guys about the different programs. ARC, and correct me if I'm wrong, and this isn't part of the interview, but ARC just seems to be like head and shoulders above every other program. And only because it really seems to, like, make very tangible, real changes that result in freedom for people and get, and, you know, have really helped a lot of guys get out. And there are more guys. I mean, I know that Kay is waiting for the same sort of review. So am I, just help me out here. Am I perceiving that incorrectly? I know you talk about ARC in conjunction with a lot of other entities and nonprofits and grassroots things that are out there, but it just seems like ARC has accomplished so damn much.
I would say definitely some truth to that. And I think a lot of that was established when it was first being formed by Scott. And part of that was realizing that the system itself had to change. It had to have structural changes, right? Mm. There had to be changes to the law. And the one thing that he did is take formerly incarcerated people up to the California legislators in Sacramento and let them see what we look like and who we are, right? Mm-hmm. We're not what's portrayed on Law and Order and shows like this, right? And that helped make changing laws a little bit easier, right? So, and when you get to the programs that we actually facilitate in Pelican Bay, for instance, I went through the same program when I was incarcerated at Ironwood State Prison. So the Hope and Redemption team, specifically Cesar Zuniga and Jamel Carter, were my life coaches, and they were acting in the same capacity that I'm acting in now. But I remember when they came into class and they're like, we're both former lifers. We're both currently on parole. We got found suitable for parole, and this is how we did it. And then when I'm sitting there listening to them, I'm like, well, they were actually in my shoes, right? They know how to navigate this landscape. And now they're out on parole and back in prison coming to help us and to show us the way, right? So the fact that they came back in was one thing after spending so long in prison. Who wants to come back into a prison? Mm-hmm. But the fact that they came back in said a lot about the character of these men. And then the depth of knowledge that they had about the board process and just prison in general and what it takes to get out helped me gravitate towards that, because I still had a couple like missing pieces, and I had done over 1,000 hours of self-help groups.
Wow.
By the time I entered their group, right? And they helped fill in those missing pieces. One second, the mailman is at the door. Thank you. So I think that peer-to-peer model works well, and I think that's one of the things that the gentlemen on the inside of the institutions where we deliver programs understand, that like there is a way home and we can illuminate that path. You have to do the work though, but we can kind of show you the path to get back to your family.
And that's just it. It's the showing. It's like, you have to do the work, but I'm not a person in authority. I'm not a person with a gun. I'm not even a person who's just coming in from the outside. When you've got somebody who's been there, who's been in the shoe, who's been in your shoes, been in your situation, saying, you got to do the work just like I did, that goes so much farther. That's one thing I've picked up from being inside. That you're right. That peer-to-peer thing is huge to the guys inside.
Yes, yes. And I'm just honored to actually be able to go in there and interact and kind of give them this knowledge, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because as I tell people all the time, like they're some of the most amazing men you ever want to meet in Pelican Bay.
Yeah.
Right. They just need, you know, to be shown the way, and they were doing amazing work before we got here, you know? So we were just kind of enhancing what's already being done. And since Pelican Bay is the only super maximum security prison in the state, I think we'll be able to change the narrative about what incarceration looks like and who should be able to come back home to their families, because they're starting to come home. I mean, this year alone, we've provided over 30 ride homes to individuals paroling from Pelican Bay.
Wow.
And every time I do a ride home, we have four separate drivers, but every time I do a ride home, there is nothing more beautiful than seeing an individual step into their freedom and all the potential that comes along with that, and being able to bear witness to that moment, kind of how you did with David. That's an incredible thing that I'm always honored to be a part of, because when we're talking about criminal justice reform, we're talking about, you know, or at least me, I'm talking about the release of people from prison, mm-hmm. right? And getting them back to their families. How does that happen? And I'm just glad that I'm able to be a part of that process.
So let's wrap up with this. What is the work you do now with the Anti-Recidivism Coalition as a hope and redemption coach? Is that the term that you used?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm a hope and redemption team life coach. Myself and Joseph Osorio both deliver rehabilitative programs to Pelican Bay State Prison. And what we do is go in and we facilitate three separate classes, one being Criminals and Gang Members Anonymous, the other one being a board preparation class, and the last being an emotional intelligence class. All three of these classes are really character development classes at their core. And then there's a lot of other information that can help individuals understand the board process if they have to go to board. The emotional intelligence, there's stuff in there about how you manage your emotions, even when you're experiencing the most adverse, you know, experience one can experience in life. How do you control these emotions and channel them in a positive direction, right? So these are kind of the classes we run. Also do advocacy work. So I advocated for Prop 17, which allows individuals who are on parole now can vote. Right. So I wanted to play an active role in advocating for that for myself and 50 other thousand people in the state of California who couldn't vote because they were on parole. So still do the advocacy work and do the classes. When COVID hit, we had to change the way we do business. We weren't able to go on site because we definitely didn't want to be the ones introducing COVID into the institution. So we started doing correspondence courses. So we've ran three cohorts during COVID. We're currently on our third cohort. I think we've graduated almost 700 students, and we're probably going to graduate around 200 more in the next 2 months.
Hold on. Just at the Bay?
Just at Pelican Bay.
Wow.
Since we've been there. So we're on our fourth cohort. We're on our third cohort since COVID. And we've been there probably around 18 months. Mm-hmm. And we deliver these programs on every yard in the institution, A, B, C, and D, and in RCGP. That's kind of what we do out there. And the main thing, you know, we want to give these men, you know, hope, to let them know, hey, you can get home to your family, and this is one way you can do it.
And not just get home to your family. You can get home to your family and you can get back into your life, and you've got skills and tools that you need to succeed with that. That's it's one thing just to get guys out of prison, but it's one thing to get them out and to set them up and to help them like stand on their own two feet. I think that's remarkable.
Definitely, definitely. And we have those employment opportunities for them also, especially if they're paroling in Los Angeles. But even if they're paroling to Sacramento and some other counties, we try and have employment opportunities because we know employment is a huge part mm-hmm. of staying out of prison. But we just want to prep them for that day when they walk out to make sure that they got everything they need to live a beautiful life. And I think that's the main difference between, you know, now and 10 years ago. You can get out and you can live a beautiful life. You can be employed and you could experience the highest levels of success. You just got to be willing to do the work. And we're seeing a lot of our formerly incarcerated brothers and sisters do just that. So hopefully we'll be able to get a lot more people from Pelican Bay home to their families by the services we deliver.
And it has been, there's two things I want to leave with here now. One is, first off, let me ask, is there anything that I didn't ask or didn't get a chance to say that you want to get in?
I think you covered it pretty well.
Well, yeah, you covered it, but it's, and then the last thing, I don't know, it's been almost a year to the day. I just realized this today. It was, it was a year ago today that I opted voluntarily. I'm going to stay out of the class. The last class I had in a week, it was a Thursday, and not go into B yard. And it occurred to me that, and then like the next day, I got an email from the PIO saying, yeah, things are suspended for now. So it's been like a year to the day. You haven't been back in all of that time, right?
Nah, we've just been we've been doing the correspondence.
Has it been working okay as the cohort? I know it's a, it's an entirely different field, but have there been challenges that you faced doing that?
Definite challenges, you know, when you have to go through. So we drop off and pick up homework packets weekly, every Friday. And when you're going through 230 homework packets and you have to offer all the students feedback and you really have to take the time and read and see what they're saying, see if there's somewhere that they need guidance or there are parts and pieces that they're doing very, very well. You want to acknowledge that. But offering them feedback, all that takes time, effort, and energy, right? So it's been a challenge. Just the time it takes to go through all those packets has been extremely challenging, but we still get it done, and we still get it put into the system that they graduated from our classes. We still issue the certifications acknowledging the accomplishments, so it still gets done. And then you miss the students, right? You miss that face-to-face interaction with them when you can provide feedback instantaneously, right? And then you get that energy from them too, that energy to want to go out here and advocate and to be the voice for them. So we missed the on-site classes. We're hoping we'll be back in there, you know, within the next 6 months would be wonderful. I'm fully vaccinated. You know, I get tested routinely because I think those things are important. And hopefully, you know, that'll expedite the process of us being able to deliver rehabilitative programs again. So we look forward to it. I'm just happy that our students are still engaged in the rehabilitative process because that's what's most important. We want to give them the tools they need to get found suitable and to get home to their families and to stay home. Because the message is in the name, right? Anti-recidivism coalition. We don't want them coming back.
That's it exactly. Wow. Hey, Mark, thank you very much, man. You covered all of that. We're rolling at 32 minutes right now. I'll do what I can to get this down to about 5 or 7 minutes or so for the podcast to kind of fit. I've got a big long interview with David that's been recorded as well as the stuff that we did the day he got out. And then I wanted to get, I don't know if you ever met him, Brian Yang. I wanted to get him on the phone too, 'cause he got out, he was in with David, and he got out, oh gosh, more than a year ago. Maybe a year and a half ago, and has been out. And I wanted to kind of talk to somebody who's been out like that and see if he had any insight as well.
Definitely, definitely. And if I could just add one thing about David, he's highly motivated. He's one of the most highly motivated people I've ever met, you know, in this line of work. I look forward to seeing him prosper. I know he's going to do exactly that. So yeah, he's going to do great things out here. I'm just going to look, I'm going to lean back and see him do those things and be highly appreciative that he's out here so he can do those things now.
He's already showing up in pictures with Scott Budnick in the Hollywood Hills, man. Did you see that?
You, I did. I did, man. I did. And I like the video that you did as well, man. I thought that was incredible, man, to see someone step into their freedom like that. Because a lot of times there's a lot of reservation. I mean, people want to be out and they're happy to be out. But just to see someone step fully into their freedom like that was amazing.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. And it was an honor to witness a day like that and something you do on the regular. But the biggest thing for me with that video was that the PIO contacted me and asked if they could get permission to play it on the institutional channels inside. So by now, I'm hoping the guys inside have seen that video as well, and it's a message of hope for them.
Yes, I agree with that. And maybe I can collaborate with you on some videos in the future, man. I would love to do that.
Oh, hey, yeah, let me know. Let me know, 'cause yeah, I love being a part of that and seeing that. So if you want me to document anything that you're a part of, or somebody getting out to drive home, anything like that, yeah, let me know.
All right, cool. Thank you, Paul. I really appreciate your time. And if there's any way I can ever be of assistance, please let me know, and I'm more than happy to do it.
Right back at you, Mark. Thank you, man.
All right, have a good one.
You too.